Welcome. This is an audio recording of the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. I'm Jim Falk, President of the Council. The Council is a nonprofit membership organization dedicated to engaging the public in an exploration of global issues and foreign affairs, and we produce over 80 public events each year. To learn more about us or to become a member, visit dfwworld.org. This podcast is made possible through the generous support of Haynes & Boone, LLP. We hope you enjoy it.
Thank you so much. We're glad to host you here at Jones Day today. This is very much in keeping with our firm, which is to try to advance the rule of law around the world. And so we're very excited to have you here today, Steve. Steve got to start after getting out of school. He went to graduate school from Fresno State. He earned a master's degree in journalism from Columbia in 81. And then he gained experience as an investigative journalist all around the world, Soviet Union, Pakistan, Philippines, writing for a number of publications that you know and esteem, the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Newsweek, Financial Times. That career has led him to serve where he is today in Washington, D.C., as the Washington correspondent for Quartz, and he divides his time. He also teaches as an adjunct professor on security issues at Georgetown, and he's a fellow at the New America Foundation. He's also the author of three books, and they're all books that we should read. One is The Oil and the Glory, which chronicles the struggle for power in the Caspian Sea. A year later, that was in 2007, a year later in 2008, he released his second book, which focused on the life and death of numerous people in Russia. Extremely topical now. It's entitled Putin's Labyrinth. So I hope that there's another edition of the book being released so you can capture the renewed interest in those topics. And his book that we're going to be talking about today, or he's going to be talking about today, is The Powerhouse, Inside the Invention of the Battery to Save the World. Mr. Steve Levine, please make him welcome.
Thanks so much for coming tonight. Terrible weather. We really just expected. I expected Jim to come. Seriously, I did. I say when I came, is anyone here? So thanks for that. What a great World Affairs Council this is in Dallas. Everywhere you go in the country, other World Affairs Councils talk about this one, and it really is it's special. I appreciate it. Because of the time when I lived here, how it made me welcome and brought me into the community, into the international community, just having moved back to the States from abroad. But then the friendship that's continued since I moved to Washington 6 years ago, 6, 7 years ago. So thanks very much for having me, Jim, and keep going with this great program. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the powerhouse, but I also, we're at a time, just speaking of those other books, we're at a really tense time right now with Russia. So if anyone at any point, but not this second, wants to talk about murders in Russia or all of that, we can do that too. We can do that later. First question I always get when I mention the book I just wrote, or all the way along when I was writing the book, when I conceived of the book, is, why are you writing a book on batteries? And my wife said it was a boring topic. My agent didn't answer my email the first time I told him I was going to do this. And just generally speaking, this sort of eyes glazed over. You mean those things that I put into the remote? You're going to write a book about that? And so I want to explain what I saw. I started this back in 2010. I started this topic, so my thing is energy. So I'm energy guy. But I don't care about energy. So I do energy when it has an impact on big geopolitics. So I use energy as a lens, as a way of analyzing what's going on, what I think is going on, and forecasting. And what I saw in 2010 was this frenzy beginning. A bunch of nations, and I started counting, and there were 20 nations, all of them had decided they were going to own the future industry in super batteries. Super batteries being, take your standard lithium ion battery that you do buy at the supermarket and make it five times as powerful at the same price. Or even less price, right? Even lower price. You want to be sized in an electric car. You want, at that scale, you want your electric car to be able to sit agnostically side by side in a showroom. You walk in, based on taste, you choose, you want a combustion car, electric car, want black, purple, like that. And all of these countries decided they were going to win. They were either going to make the big breakthrough and create that super battery, or they were going to own some piece of the expected big electric car industry. And the U.S. was in this. Obama said, we're going to have 1 million electric cars on the road in the mid-decade, meaning this year. China made exactly the same forecast. You're going to have a million, we're going to have a million. And that's really the way it was. It was this tit for tat. Everyone was going to beat everyone else. And it almost didn't matter whether the objective was real or not, whether it was realistic or not. What mattered is that everyone thought it was realistic. And the numbers they were looking at made them very excited. It made me very excited. So, talking about industries matching today's Toyota in gross income, $100 billion industries by the 2020s, electric cars, multiple companies selling 15% of all new car sales were forecast were going to be electric cars. And so I started thinking about, okay, if this happens, if this is real, what does that mean? And, well, one thing it would mean is that when you look at forecasts, when you're looking at forecasts now, the forecast hasn't changed much. But back then, the trajectory of oil consumption over the coming one decade, two decades, the growth of oil consumption was almost totally in China. Most of it in China, some in India and the Middle East. Why the Middle East? Because Middle Eastern countries are burning more and more oil to satisfy their electricity supply, their electricity demands. So when you looked at that, and you thought, well, what if those 400 million cars that are forecast to go on China's roads by the year 2030 aren't gasoline-driven cars, or if some of them, or if many of them, are not gasoline-driven cars, but they are electric cars, or partially electric cars, if they're hybrid cars? You saw that forecast for oil demand over the coming decade or two was going to be wrong. That trajectory was going to be a little bit lower. And then all the way down the line, the supply, the demand that the suppliers were relying on for their well-being, right? OPEC, Russia, they rely when they're producing oil. The same thing that we're watching today, basically the same thing that we're watching today with shale oil. Shale oil over the last 3 years, 4 million barrels of shale oil has gone onto the market. Suddenly, over the last eight months, The market has taken cognizance of it. The price of oil unexpectedly has been cut in half. Russia has been undermined. OPEC has fallen into chaos. Iran is more eager to sign a nuclear deal. These were the sort of outcomes that I was looking at back in 2010 from batteries. But on the other side of the ledger, right? It's not that there would be supply. It would be that there would be less demand for oil. You would still have a surplus on the market. So this appealed to me. This is big geopolitics. You would have, if this transpired, the future that these countries were all forecasting of a new electric car age, you would shake up geopolitics everywhere. So I got pretty interested in that. And then I looked at the technologies themselves and just the commercial technologies that have been important, that have been consequential over the last 3, 4, 5 decades. And when you think about that, there's been one or two. Well, there's been GPS, polio vaccine. There's been the ARPANET leading to the internet. But the transistor has been a central actor in all of these developments. The commercialization of the transistor is a towering commercial achievement of the last 5 decades, probably unmatched. But the other one is the lithium-ion battery. Lithium-ion battery made these electronics portable. Tesla, Apple, Samsung, two of the companies would not exist, and Samsung would not exist at this scale if it were not for the lithium-ion battery. You wouldn't have, this man would not have his smartphone. I'm not interrupting you. Okay. So I'm just joking with you. I want to check my email too. So when I looked at that, at the scale of the consequence that lithium-ion batteries have had commercially over the last 5 decades, this was a lot of appeal to for a story. But I didn't want to tell the story in the way that I'm just describing, right? At this sort of 50,000 foot view, that's one way of writing a book. A lot of people do it that way. If there was a race on, I wanted to be with America's team. I want to sit with America's team. It's fun. It's okay. And this is a future battery man, by the way. He's going to the University of Chicago. He's already told me he's going to invent the super battery. I made a pitch, by the way, Jim. I visited one of the Bell High School and pitched the students that one of them should invent the super battery. So I wanted to... You can be skeptical about whether this race was realistic. Are electric cars a niche vehicle? Can the super battery be invented? Or you can be an enthusiast. Of course they're going to happen. If they're inevitable, whatever the case is, what makes battery guys tick? The race was really going on. There were real battery guys in labs who were trying to make this breakthrough. What were they doing? So I found one. I found the closest thing to America's team in the race, and this was a group of battery guys at Argonne National Lab, one of the 17 federally funded labs out in Chicago. It has a long history. It's the first national lab. This is where, at its precursor, Enrico Fermi created the first self-sustained nuclear chain reaction. And then that lab went on to become the Argonne that we know today. They're about in the world, 20 or so certified recognized battery geniuses, and two of them are at Argonne. Their stuff is in the Chevy Bolt. So this was hitting all the right boxes. So I went out and did a story with these guys. One of the really neat things out there was that one was pretty interesting. When I went there, it coincided with the visit of the Chinese Minister of Science and Technology. He was there the same day. So the Bête Noire, right, the enemy, he's there. They're there together. This could not be more perfect. And the other thing was that America's team was almost all foreigners. Mm-hmm. This was an interesting thing for me. And the third thing was that they had not been discovered. So I Googled around, and Chicago Tribune had written about them. Chicago Tonight were the local PBS station. But no national media had understood what was going on there. It was national media is very, very interested in the splash, right? In some press release goes out, we've made an incredible breakthrough. We're going to revolutionize batteries tomorrow, and that gets a lot of press. One, I'm just going to say this parenthetically. I would come to it later, but this is a good spot. One of the things you discover about battery guys is they're big bullshitters. So all of technology has exaggerators, right? This is the way that you have to be in order to get funding. In order to get VC funding, you exaggerate what you're doing and what you can do, and you hope everyone believes you until you go IPO and get rich. But battery guys are exceptionally big liars. So Edison said this. I didn't make this up myself. In the 1920s, when Edison was making attempting to make an electric car and going through his iterative process, right, going hundreds and hundreds of different formats and ways of doing this battery, he finally, in a written statement in The Electrician, which is a magazine, he said, I'm paraphrasing, but something like, there's something about rechargeable batteries that turn inventors into liars. It was very frustrating. And this plays out to today, is that because the stakes are so high, the stakes that I described, right, reducing your gasoline bill, reducing your electric bill in your home, just on a personal level, creating national wealth, creating new industries. National wealth translates into geopolitical influence, geopolitical power, undermining countries whose foreign policies diverge from your own and have frustrated your foreign policies for decades. These are the stakes, and the payoff. That stakes and payoff, minting billionaires, right, making a lot of rich people. Because the stakes are so high, but the task is so difficult. So we have Voyager spacecraft traveling outside the solar system right now. They're sending radio signals. The performance of silicon wafers double every 18 months and have been doing so for three decades. So what's the problem with the battery? Who here can tell me? Future battery man. When was the battery invented?
You mean the original?
No, the first battery.
Talking back that battery?
Oh, you're really... it's no good, man. I'm not answering any questions. 1799. Alessandro Volta. 1799. So, study up, man. Okay. So, 1799. This is over two centuries. What is the problem with the battery? And we have been misled. by our own lives. We have adopted the Apollo myth, right? That all you have to do is declare a stretch goal and a date certain, you know, throw a lot of money at it, and you're going to get that outcome. But batteries aren't like that. Batteries are these very difficult creatures. They're not straightforward like a silicon chip, where you squeeze a greater number of transistors on that wafer all day, and when you come back in the morning, everything is still exactly in the same place. That's child's play. So with batteries, so the battery guys who I'm dealing with, they wanted to take the stuff that's in the Chevy Bolt and turn that into a super battery, and in the lab, they had discovered that when they applied much greater voltage to this chemistry, they're working at 3.3 volts, those who understand that electrochemistry, and they wanted to juice it to 4.7 volts. As soon as you go above 4.5 volts, you create this pop, and the capacity just goes out of this world, and you have your super battery. And they showed this at the cell level and sold this patent, Argonne did, this patent showing this to GM, LG Chem, the South Korean, gargantuan South Korean chemical company, Toda from Japan, BASF, the Germans, all of them licensed this stuff. Under the, they knew there was tweaking to be done, but with this great confidence that this is the super battery, what everyone discovered quickly, and this happens in the book, is that when you scale the stuff up, it's chaos. It's chaos. That cathode that they're applying the 4.7 volts to turns into mayhem. The atoms start moving everywhere and lock into places where they shouldn't be. It's just as a metaphor for this, it is as though when you drive home tonight to your house, that when you drive into your garage, you attempt to drive into your garage, that garage is in the attic. And the front room is in the neighbor's yard. This is the basically it transmogrifies into a different material. And the lithium, by the way, the way the lithium ion battery works is very, very simple. It's stored in that cathode. When you pick up a battery, or when you start up your electric car for the very first time, that stuff is in the cathode, all of it. And then it starts, when you start driving, it starts moving. Little by little, it moves to the other electrode. And then when you plug it back in, when you plug the car back in, when you've exhausted the battery, the lithium goes back to the cathode. But if all the atoms have moved all over the place, the lithium has a hard time finding out where it should go. And then you're cycling over and over, then you're driving your car again, and then you're plugging it in again, and you do it over and over again, and pretty soon, very soon, the battery's gone haywire. And so this is one of the tasks. This is one of the tasks of that I chronicle in the book, is the objective of getting those atoms to stay in place. Stop moving around, guys. And the other one, another answer for the super battery that does not equate to the silicon chip. The other electrode, so one of the miracle materials, silicon. Let's make the other, right now it's graphite, and it's storing the lithium in graphite. It's perfect, it just sits there, it's inert. It's a welcome home, but itself, since it's inert, it is empty weight. in the battery. It has no, it only serves as a home. It doesn't add anything to the energy. If they could put silicon, well, lithium metal would be one option, but silicon. Lithium metal catches on fire, by the way. But if you put silicon in there, which doesn't catch on fire, that you would get a 60% jump. 60% jump in your performance right away. Silicon, though, swells when the lithium goes in there four times its size. So that same example we were looking at, it's as though you go to your house and your house has swallowed up all the neighbors. It's just huge. And so this is it. So the battery is not the silicon wafer. It's not the Voyager spacecraft either. It is one of those 18th or 19th century mathematical puzzles that you hear about every so often that everyone thought was unsolvable, that suddenly gets solved by some guy in some, you know, musty room thinking about this in a way that no one else did, and finally resolves it and wins the Nobel Prize. This is what it is. This is the task of that. That's why we don't have the super battery. But we need the super battery. Super battery, there's almost no other invention, and in my opinion, there is no other invention, but, you know, just to be moderate, I'll say almost, that would have as consequential an impact on our daily lives on so many levels, right? On a big scale and on a small scale, than having that super battery, being able to store electricity that's created by solar and wind, storing fossil fuel energy in low use periods for use at peak periods, reducing the amount of fossil fuels that are burned in your electricity bills. These payoffs are so high that it merits, and really it's a compulsion. We must keep trying to create the super battery. I just want to point out two more things, and then Jim and I are going to have a little conversation. We'll have. Do you have any questions there? I see you have a furrowed brow. Are you upset that the super battery wasn't invented? All right. Okay, hang on. Let me just tell these two little things. I promise they'll be little. All right. One thing that happens in the book that is what's very surprising for me is that the battery guys, they call themselves battery guys, by the way. This is their nomenclature. And they, to insult other people, they say they're not battery guys. They decide that everything they're doing is wrong. Every path they're taking is the wrong path. And that every path that everyone else is taking around the world that they know about is the wrong path too. And they say this publicly. And we need to start over. We need to start from scratch, figure out what's going on at a molecular level, create a roadmap to the future, to that future super battery. It's an astonishing public admission that you just don't see. And that is very, very important that happened. But the other thing that happens, I'm just looping back to these lying battery guys. And that's that. Did I talk about NVIDIA mixed up? Because I'm already, this is my fourth talk that you've had. This guy is having me working all day. Okay. All right. And you know, when you keep, then did you forget, did I already say that? All right. Did I already compliment you? Yeah. All right. So, yeah. So I had already written the whole book. I had written three quarters of the book. I had spent my 2 years in the lab. I negotiated for a year to get 1 year, in the lab. I stayed for 2 years. And I got a phone call at night that one of the key sources, a key source for the end of the book, The Hollywood Finish, had been BSing. Had been BSing the whole time. That he did not have what he said he had. And now he was not only BSing me, he was BSing GM. GM, which had signed a contract with him, with them, that company, that startup company, that also, by the way, I mentioned all these companies that had licensed the miracle material that was going to produce the super battery at 4.7 volts. This stuff was also licensed by a startup in California, Silicon Valley. And exaggerated to GM. GM had announced, Dan Ackerman, then the CEO, had announced 3 or 4 times, we're going to have a 200-mile car. He even said, we're going to have a 300-mile car. This was based on the material from this startup. ARPA-E, this offshoot, pardon me.
And GM had paid them $4 million.
And there was $4 million at stake. Mm. Yeah. GM had paid them. I thought you said MGM. I thought it was MGM in my book. Yeah. Okay.
That's
my
book.
So, God, I missed that, yeah. So, ARPA-E, the Radical Innovation Lab associated with the Energy Department, had showcased this startup in Washington as, you know, one of these miracle startups. Anyway, it turned out that they did not have what they said they had, and so I had to recast the book, and you know, the beginning of the book, and then recast the ending of the book, because the GM had to scramble, and it's marketing. This is it turns out to be a good story. For me, it turns out to be a positive story because the book is more honest. Right? It's you get how batteries really are. Right? There's no how, you know, you get the real story of how invention really works, dispelling myths, outing the hucksters, right? That you know, you gotta have your antenna up, basically. One of the battery guys said, you not only have to listen to what the battery guy is saying, but you have to listen to every sentence and make sure that every sentence in the paragraph is true. Which is true. So it was good for GM. GM is marketing a 200-mile car. It pivoted. LG Chem figured out a way to make a purer version of this argon material, the stuff that's in the volt. Use more of it, keep it stabilized, and GM has announced. It announced and it unveiled this car, the Bolt, at the Detroit Auto Show a few weeks ago. It's going to cost $35,000, 200 miles on a single charge. This is a sweet spot. 200 miles. Well, we don't know what is the mileage. What is the distance where you lose your range anxiety, where you no longer worry, hey, I'm gonna run out of electricity. Is it 200 miles? Is it 300 miles? But 200 is a good number. And $35,000, this is a number that Americans are accustomed to paying for their cars. The average price that Americans paid last year for their new cars was $33,000. Elon Musk says he's going to market his own 200-mile $35,000 car also in 2018. That one's called the Model 3. And then Apple. We had news 2 weeks ago, three weeks ago, that Apple is in the electric car game. It's going to market, and it may, I don't know whether it will, but it may launch. They've hired poached hundreds of battery guys from other companies in order to produce their product. This is critical mass, right? GM may not be able to compete with Tesla head-to-head, but Apple can. So you know, suddenly you have these cars on the market that They're not in the middle of the mass market price. They're not 25,000, but 35,000. This is a reasonable price. It's 3 years from now. Because of that, I've got confidence that we're in this valley of death right now, low oil prices, but 3 short years after that, we're entering the electric age. Thank you very much.
You keep it.
Okay.
Steve, one of the things you mentioned at one of your earlier talks today was, why did they let you, someone as dangerous as you, into that lab?
Okay, so I'll tell it, but this was a hilarious, mind-boggling thing. So I've been expelled from Russia and Uzbekistan. I was wounded in Chechnya. I was captured with a coup leader in the Philippines. I've covered wars all over the world. The thing that they didn't believe was that my boyhood best friend had the same name as the lead battery scientist. Such a liar. I was making stuff up. It's pretty crazy. Anyway, I put my mom on the phone. Smartphone. Mom, what was the name of my best friend in high school? She said, without the phone, you put your mom up to that. Anyway, it wasn't easy. So they were eager to have a book, the book that I describe, right? Describing the daily life, right? What is it like to attempt to make a big leap in this area, right? And not be dumbed down, right? You don't have to know anything to read the book, but you get the science. You're taken into Silicon Valley, you know, the big geopolitics. They were eager for that, but they're very cautious, and so they gave the right signals, and I sold the book to Viking, promising Argon, before Argon agreed. And so finally...
So you're a bullshitter.
Yeah, you're a bullshitter.
I forgot to say that part. A bullshitter knows a bullshitter. All right. So, I'm going to make you pay for that. All right. So, at the end of the year, I realized that it just wasn't going anywhere. It wasn't going to get the final mile. So I called David Sandilow, the Deputy Secretary of Energy, and asked him if he could do anything. And he had written a book on electric cars himself in 2006. So he was in. He was in on this. He called Argon, and within 10 minutes of my having that conversation, I got an email from the head of the battery department, Jeff Chamberlain. I don't know what happened, but you're in. But I had to sign an NDA, and the NDA was that we're going to call on you, okay, and you too, okay. Do you want one? No. Okay. Okay. So specifically about NVIDIA, the startup, I explore that question. Are they shysters? You know, did they know the whole time that not only well they knew they didn't have it, but did they know that they would not have it? Did they know? You know, did they actively deceive everyone, or did they maliciously, right, deceive everyone? And so I come down that they did knowingly deceive everyone, and they did which you'll find, right? They at certain moments, they show certain charts and not. They swap charts, right? There's this thing, I'll just very, like 10 seconds, it's just this technical thing. If you want to understand this haywire, the battery going haywire, you need to look at the energy density. It's a chart that plots the energy density of the battery. At the point in their presentation at which they're showing, we solved this problem, they swap the charts to energy capacity. And energy capacity doesn't show the haywire. It shows the steady performance. So yes, they did knowingly deceive, but I also decided that they got in over their head. They fell in to this Silicon Valley mantra.
They wanted $1 billion.
Billion dollar IPO. They wanted that billion. Thank you, Jim. They did. I forgot that. And
I read the book more recently than you.
Then I did. And so they got caught up in the whole Silicon Valley thing. They thought, well, maybe we can do it. You know? And so that's how it happened.
You had a comment or question?
Yeah. But I wanted to know, first of all, the battery guys addressed the issue of the disposal of the batteries, the life of the batteries and the disposal afterwards and what's done, because that's always been such a big issue. The other thing is, you're in a great place here because North Texas has one of the higher numbers of recharging stations. I don't know if folks know that, but even more so than Austin. And I don't know, I'd like to find out if they think about that and how they interact with the location of recharging stations or that individual.
Yeah, they don't. They don't.
Simply.
Yeah, so really the whole activity that's going on in that lab is creating the super battery. And they're not thinking at all about, okay, what are we going to do with this thing next?
Some people. Yeah, that's an approach to focus on the
trying to get it done. And,
In the back. Yeah. Question, the whole conversation seems to be arcing on what cars are going to do. I mean, the sort of the poverty alleviation aspect of the super battery, where if you've got a little solar panel, you can charge a village and clean their water for a year. That has nothing to do with cars. Are the people at Argonne and in the system thinking about your utility scale batteries? Because they can have the silicon battery and they can swell all you want. It's not driving up and down the toll.
Short answer is yes. Right. So when the when this moment happens that it's decided that everything that everyone is doing is wrong, they got to start over. What happens is that Secretary Chu, Secretary of Energy, from Bell Labs, right, decides that the way to resolve the biggest energy problems in the country is to establish some form of invention, a mini Bell Labs, a number of mini Bell Labs in different national labs or universities that would focus on those questions. And a competition is held for a battery lab. And it has been, it's been won. That battery lab has been won. I'm not going to say by who, but it's in Chicago. It's got two missions. So one, within 5 years, so by 2018, it has to produce prototypes. A prototype of battery prototypes that are five times the performance at one-fifth the price for the grid and for cars. And the thing is, if I get into the grid thing, that's a whole other kettle of fish, but it has the same potential geopolitical impact. And the thing about it is just what you just said, which is that the technology is already there. It's the cost quotient. You need to cut the cost to one-fourth of the current price, but that's a manufacturing issue. That's a scale-up issue that can be done.
Right.
Yeah.
Right over there. And
oh, you have.
No, you go there. Yeah. I had a comment I wanted to go back on the BS issue in the electronics industry, which is a portion of, versus venture capitalists. As a technologist myself, there's a blurred line between confidence and overconfidence in what you do. What happens in the venture capitalist community is they look for a team that has executed something prior to this, and then somewhere in that whole mix, they say, if I can grab $100 million, put the right amount of scientists in the room, and start fooling with this stuff, we can come up with something that's close. So that's where arrogance kicks in, saying, we have a team. They're usually PhDs that are Chinese and Indian, and the VCs in, you know, in California go, these guys are the smartest guys in the room, throw money at them. And then they get money thrown at them, and they sometimes make it, and they sometimes don't. So this blurred line of where's the arrogance and where's the confidence, and that's when you get companies like Tesla, like Google. These guys do make it, and that's why the venture capitalists keep sending money to these companies, and people say, I can do it. So it's a blurred line, but it happens. And you do have to put a little bit of BS in that, because you're saying in the future. You're saying, how tall is your kid going to be? Is he going to be playing basketball? I don't know. I guarantee my son's going to be tall. My grandfather was tall. That's all conjecture, right? Hmm. But in electronics, there is a lot of revival. There's a lot of ego. And it's, I can do it if I put the right team together. You give me enough money. And that's how this whole industry works. Hmm. So it's a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Yeah. And it's a blurred line.
Wes, you had something?
No, thanks for that comment.
I'm going to respond to that. I've got a question. So, revealing that I'm a lawyer, I do, among other things, white collar criminal defense. all of that bravado is fine until you turn into Enron and you go public. And you say, we have this technology for water treatment or whatever, and then you've got representation of the public. So the fine line, there's a clear line at some point, particularly when you go public and you're making representations. My question about the global implications, to pick up the question from the battery guys in the back of the room, is, I've not seen much about this, but it seems to me on the grid piece that one of the great challenges we have, of course, is with terrorism, and particularly in Africa and the Middle East. If you can empower villages to not have to be connected to the grid, but have their own power, now they're much less vulnerable to fluctuations in the grid. They stand alone. They can provide educational opportunities. They have computers. Their kids can be empowered. And the extent that there are bad things happening elsewhere in the country, they kind of stand alone. They don't have to depend on the grid. And it gives, I think, more power to the people and less power to the despots.
Yeah. So this is one of the forecasts. So I was just talking to someone day before yesterday about Myanmar. So Myanmar, 70% of the country is not on the grid. There just is no grid for 70%. This is a perfect place, right, to install solar and batteries. It's too expensive for a country like Myanmar to install, you know, a grid system, and it's not necessary. Right. So anyway, I'm reiterating what you're saying in another way. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Do you have a question though?
This book that I've not bought it, I just bought two copies. I'm going to read one and give one away.
Okay.
But Daniel Nocera, who's doing a battery thing, he's doing it with photosynthesis.
Yeah.
That obviously is not a focus of this, but another player in that field. Yeah, so have you had a chance to look at his stuff and have your...
No, but someone, when I spoke at MIT, who's that guy who he works with? Said, if you want to look at one of the greatest rivalries in science, Dan Nocera and that other guy, there's one in California and one at MIT, on in this photosynthesis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just as a coincidence, I was reading today that United Parcel Service, UPS, had the job of shipping vast amounts of lithium-ion batteries from the manufacturer to, I guess, the United States. Well, over the years, 2 747s have been destroyed and was killed by onboard fires. Apparently, the manufacturer said these are safe shipment supply of batteries. Well, they've had 2 747s fall in the sky, so they're not shipping them anymore. So, what's the thing about that? Is that in the life?
Well, I'm, if, you know, 747s don't fall out of the sky, and you don't read about it in the newspaper. So who published that?
Maybe you need to, you know, it's just interesting to find out.
Yeah, okay, but let me just say that there are cases, though, that I do know, Dreamliner, mean, the Dreamliner is so.
This was not the 787
battery. Sorry, say again.
787 batteries, auxiliary power batteries.
Right, that delayed the plane. No,
this was
No, I understand. We're talking about two different things. Yeah. But since I don't know that one, let me talk about the one I do know about. Yeah. Yeah. So the battery, so there are a number of different major formulations that all of them go under the rubric lithium ion batteries. They're not all the same. But the one that's in all of your smartphones, all of your laptops, any electronic device that you have on your person right now is one called lithium cobalt oxide. And it's the most stable, it is the most powerful, the most energetic, the most energy dense. This is why it's used. It's also the most volatile of all of them. And so it's safe in these small quantities that are in your smartphone. But Boeing adopted this specific formulation for the 787. I called Argonne. Did you know they're using lithium cobalt oxide in the 787? They just couldn't believe it. You know, it's just incredible. There are other formulations that pack less of a punch, but that are much less likely to catch fire. Elon Musk uses it's one called NCA, nickel cobalt aluminum, and it's less. Again, less powerful than the cobalt, but it packs, apart from lithium cobalt oxide, it's the most powerful, and it doesn't catch fire. Well, look, anything can catch fire, right? Incidentally, your combustion car will also catch fire if you drive it into a pole. But under, in normal usage, it doesn't catch fire, as the Dreamliner.
On the 747, I remember reading about that.
Yeah.
They weren't using them for power. They were in the storage hold. And they did some experiments where they just took the containers and set them aside. If they're packed with a certain density, they would catch fire.
Yeah.
I don't know. And they got there.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, this is called thermal runaway. This is one of the problems with lithium ion, right? One cell malfunctions and sets everything else on fire. And right, so I mean, this is one of the engineering challenges. Yeah.
In the back.
With all the time that you spent with Argonne Labs, it strikes me with your description of it that there might be a misalignment of incentives. In that, I think of a place like Argonne or Sandy or any one of the large kind of government-sponsored research facilities as focusing much more on basic research, focusing on, say, the chemistry. What would make the most logical sense to pursue certain material types that would generate the greatest power density, the greatest capacity, charge like a capacitor, discharge like a battery, kind of super battery notion. In your time here, did you see that as being an issue? It sounds to me like they were much more on the applied side, taking kind of ideas, moving them to a set of experiments. If they didn't work, they'd start over and try again, but not in a kind of methodical way of really determining, both in theory and practice, what is the best approach to take. Do you see that?
This is correct, and the director of the lab changes while I'm there. Eric Isaacs leaves, and another Bell Labs guy, Peter Littlewood, comes in, and he's former Bell Labs and former Cavendish, and he says this. That he's not a battery guy. And he's just looking at it as a physicist, and just says, the battery, it's just this unsightly thing. We don't know what's going on inside of it. If this had been the reason that ATT existed, when he was with Bell Labs, in Bell Labs, if our reason to exist was not making telephones, but making batteries, we would have gone down to the molecular level and figured out exactly what you're saying. what is this thing, right? And then we would have created a 20-year roadmap, every single thing we were going to try to get where we wanted to go. And they didn't do that. Pardon me. They didn't. They did not. And not only they didn't, no one did that. And it's what they're starting now. But part of the reason, I should say, that the labs and this lab has an applied quality to it is Congress. Congress has for years, right, it's not something new, has urged that the labs has prized projects within the labs that have applied that can be applied in industry, and that you can demonstrate that you did it. Demonstrated application in industry. They love this. And so this, because of this, I think this is the main reason. Then you get the labs and Argonne trying to make this super battery.
Well, you talked about in the book about you're spending taxpayer money to support the labs.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons.
Yeah.
See, I saw, you had a comment or question.
Yeah. I wonder if it's fair to ask a question on Russia.
Any other battery questions? Yeah. And then we'll come back to Russia because we are running out of time. We'll take two battery questions, one and there. Woman. Man. Sir, go first, then you.
With current technology,
quick answer, Steve, too.
Are electric cars that we have on the road today, hybrids, electrics, a net positive on the environment when you take into consideration making the battery and disposing of it?
Okay. That's fine.
No, you yes, sir.
This is a highly innovative technical space, and therefore there's a lot of intellectual property in this mix. How much is the intellectual property of all these competitors working in the same field into the advancement of this technology?
And did you get the last battery question, and we'll go to Russia for a few minutes.
Okay, so I'll go ahead and answer. This question was about, I think it depends, well, I mean, it's so small right now. It's 0.4% of new car sales are electrics. But it depends. It depends where you live. If you live in a place that burns coal to create electricity, then it's, you know, you haven't advanced anything.
Right.
In fact, you're worse. If you live in a place that burns natural gas, then it's a net positive. And this was about the IP. I'm not sure that that's an issue right now. You know, there's a lot of cross-fertilization going on. I don't think, you know, someone is, they might be, you know, keeping something from everyone else when they ought to be sharing. But it is true that collaboration, it's thought, and, you know, the Argonne guys persuaded me that the way they're going to get there is through collaboration with industry, right? The national labs, the companies themselves, our big companies have given up their industrial labs. They're not by and large, not trying to make big invention. They're creating iPhones, and so they need the national labs. They need the universities in order to make the biggest breakthroughs of all. But the national labs don't know how to engineer a product, nor should they. And they don't know how to manage it. They don't know how to scale it up. So we can get together.
And our last battery comment.
It's two part. First is the when you mentioned about batteries for the community scale for powering community solar homes. There are a couple of communities here in this area, like Plano and Garland, that have done the group buying approach to solar for homes, and they would jump on the battery in a heartbeat and that's readily coming for the storage factor. So I don't know how much they're addressing that. I just want to mention this is a great area for that. The other question I had, you kind of alluded to this, what percentage of Argonne Labs funding comes from private capital and government?
So I don't know the percentage from private capital. It's almost totally federal. It's almost federal, but they do have these joint projects with various companies, and specifically this hub, this Bell Lablet, they call it, you know, mini Bell, that's attempting to figure out the pathway forward. That one is a jointly funded five companies in the federal government.
You know, it's 8 o'clock, and what I'd like, if you can stay and wish to stay, because we'll almost divide this into two parts, and we'll let Steve talk a bit about Russia, but we understand if you have to leave, and we thank you for coming. But we're really lucky to have Steve here to talk about Russia. So. You know, instead of taking a question, let's just let you go for a few minutes about Russia.
Fine.
Then we'll do a question.
All right. Just sort of what we did earlier? Yeah. Just sort of, yeah.
Well, what do you think about what happened this weekend and how strong is Putin?
Yeah.
We'll give you 10 minutes on that.
So the last book that I did, Putin's Labyrinth, is a murder. It's a murder story. It profiles Russia through six murders, and it's called Putin's Labyrinth. So it profiles what Russia is, but suggests that its past, going back centuries, point to this as its future too. And what is this that I'm talking about? And this is in this dimension that sets Russia apart from other countries with which it would like to be in the same league, the G7, for example, Europe. Yeah, is that the impunity with which killers act. So, you know, we could just add this murder onto the, you know, just tell the story. There's a whole industry, right? There's a business of murder. This is the contract killers, right? How certain types of businesses settle their matters in the end is by putting out a hit. Right? This is how things happen there. That's normal, right? That's normal in Russia. You don't have to ask anyone's permission to do that. But if you decide you want to kill someone who's a prominent, a public figure, like a prominent journalist, a prominent banker, a prominent lawyer, even. Or a prominent politician. You have to get permission. You have to at least. No one will do that. Killers, a customer himself or herself, the mastermind, and the killers themselves will not carry out such a murder unless they understand that they're not going to get in trouble from the Kremlin. Someone's not going to come down on them for this. And they learn this, right? They seek and obtain this permissions in ways that we don't know, because I presume, I mean, I'm not a killer, and I presume no one else is here either. If you are, raise your hand. Okay. But they know how to understand, how to get that signal. It's okay to do that. So Boris Nemtsov's murder got approval from the killers understood that they had approval from the very highest authority. And the other thing to understand or to know about these types of murders in Russia is that the gunmen often, if there's enough hullabaloo that erupts over the death, because sometimes there's not any, right? There's no one's upset at all about someone dying, you know, maybe, you know, the person's spouse or their kids, but not a public reaction. If there's a public reaction, the gunmen themselves may be fingered. Or not. Maybe you get gunmen who weren't gunmen and they're fingered, right? But what you never have ever gotten is the customer. No customer, no mastermind has ever been identified, and so of course, since they're not identified, they're not prosecuted, and so that leads one to to believe that that'll be the case this time too. For those who Jim, you're not one of the people who can leave early, by the way.
I know, I have to drive you home.
Okay. Has everyone watched the video? The video that's out there of the murder? So there's this is right next to the Kremlin. There are dozens of cameras on the street, right? And so there's somehow all of them were looking the other way, right? And there's one camera that's very, very far away, but is able, you see enough. One thing that you see that is so ominous is that a snowplow stops right in front of Nemtsov on the bridge. As soon as he's dead, it takes off.
Yeah.
Right? So it blocks the whole view. And so that and you see you see people running around checking the body and then running away. What's the future there? The whole picture is not good, right? So nobody forecast that Russia was going to invade Ukraine, that Russia was going to respond to this decision, go with the European, an association with the European Union, or with the Eurasian Union, the Russia-led Eurasian Union, by invading Ukraine. It seemed an incredible assertion that someone would do that, right? And that Putin has now taken him into another realm, and the realm is quite apart from how it brands him as a leader and so on. It makes him unpredictable. I mean, utterly unpredictable. Just our framework of understanding how realpolitik works. Nixon is 40 years ago. I mean, Kissinger is still alive, writing books. So we're reading. We understand realpolitik. How things, right? That sometimes you overthrow government. Sometimes leaders are assassinated, and so on. But the road that Putin has taken has gone unpredicted, and so he came back to power in 2012 after having served as prime minister, right? His resting place while Medvedev, right? So you can't run three consecutive terms. So he served two terms, took off one, and now he's back for two. It's presumed that takes until 2024. What it looks like, what the future looks like, is he understood that he could not rely on the same formula that he used to enjoy so much popularity during the 2000s, and that was the economic growth. He took a lot of people into the middle class. Suddenly, Russians had more money and were able to travel places and just enjoy their lives better than in history, than any Russian people in history. But that road was over. That was not going to be repeated. Already, oil was $103. I got to go fast, right? Okay. Already,
until they start leaving.
Okay. Oil had already averaged $106 a barrel for three straight years, and Russia's economy was suffering. So he wasn't going to be able to come back and repeat that trick. So part of what he's doing is this indignation, and I think a lot of it is pretend indignation, or maybe he believes there's reason for the indignation over the perceived hurts from the West, since the Soviet, that the blows from the West since the Soviet collapse. But I think equally, this is his formula for popularity. This is his full employment act. This is his re-election platform.
And you said earlier this morning or this afternoon that when you were asked about what might happen in other areas of the former Soviet Union, just briefly say about that.
Right. So I think that we will see uprisings of other types in other countries, specifically the Baltics. And this is we know that it's documented, right, that Russia is supporting certain political parties and political figures in the Baltics and across Europe. A number of stories have been written about this. For example, Marie Le Pen in France, that party is supported by Russia. So, you know, what you'll get, I think, is a reasonable expectation of what happens in the coming years. We don't know how many years, but it could be next year. And that's destabilization of one or more of the Baltic countries, but not an invasion of troops. It's simply you pull the trigger on these indigenous political parties that can cause mayhem in the streets.
We'll take two questions on Russia and we'll call it an evening. Yes, sir, in the back.
Just quickly, if you were president of the United States, how would you respond? What would your perspective
be? That's way above my computer. I think that engaging, it's very hard to engage Putin. So I don't think that the answer is, you know, which we've gotten, right? One administration after the other, right, thought that they knew how to deal with Putin. He needs to come back down to earth, right? And so that isn't the answer. You know,
are the sanctions working?
Sorry?
Sanctions? No.
Well, they're working in the sense that they are hurting the economy. Oil prices are also a huge blow. But he's operating on the fumes of nationalism. He's driven his country into an anti-American frenzy. When Russians, my wife is from Kazakhstan, so she talks to her. She's monitoring, you know, the whole Russia thing, but also in Kazakhstan, her friends at home, and the same thing in Russia. You see, you know, we really hope that the same thing going on in Ukraine doesn't happen here. And, you know, Nuri, I said, yeah, that's right. I hope so too. You know that Putin doesn't. What do you mean, Putin? The Americans, the Russians think, and the Cossacks think that the war in Ukraine is Americans fighting the Russians.
You had a comment, sir?
Against the background of the six murders, is there anyone out there who might do something against Putin in terms of a counter?
Yeah. Palace coup. So this is the way that when you have these kinds of societies, that changes of power ordinarily happen. When they do happen, is a palace coup, assassination, or the leader just dies. So this. There's no sign of this, by the way. There's nothing on the. I think it's pointless to watch, which a lot of people do, watch what the opposition is doing and these gatherings in the streets. This is noise, and Putin will let that dissipate, and then he'll come back and just as strong. Who is he servicing? Who is his power base? Right, and the power base. First of all, no one knows what the power base is, but it's probably the strong ministries, the security ministry, the former KGB, the interior ministry, the military, and those are the people he has to serve. You're here.
That means that we thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
For more information about the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, visit them on the web at www.dfwworld.org.